Before I introduce our guest today, I'd like to start by acknowledging the land we live upon. As visitors on this land, we have an important responsibility to acknowledge the grounds on which we are privileged to gather and to honor the Indigenous peoples who are the original stewards of these lands upon which we were all visitors each and every day. Today, we are gathered in the city of Orillia, which is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. As I reflect upon the traditional territories I have been privileged to reside upon throughout my life, I am reminded to show gratitude for this beautiful place I get to call home. When I think of home, I think of the things I love to do with my family, such as camping and hiking on the trails near our home, which always reminds me of the healing power of nature. This is a home that I can safely walk hand in hand with my children on, one that we ski upon in the winter and play upon in the summer. I'd like to give thanks to the local First Peoples for welcoming us in their homelands to be able to do all of the things we love. Acknowledgements are but one step forward towards standing up and standing with Indigenous peoples, allowing us to begin to open the door for more understanding. Growing up, land acknowledgements and showing gratitude to Indigenous peoples for welcoming us into their homelands was certainly not a part of my childhood or school learnings or dinner conversations. Now, as a parent of three children, I want to share my commitment to ongoing awareness and learning alongside my children. I want to continue to learn together about not only the historical Indigenous struggles and the reality of Indigenous peoples' treatment, but the struggles faced today as they continue to persist. The end result can only be a better and brighter future for everyone who call Indigenous lands home, and I encourage you all to do the same. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast where we delve into the heart of hospice palliative care. My name is Lori Gill, and I am the Education Specialist at North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and I will be your host today as we explore the topic of difficult conversations. This topic touches us all. How to have meaningful conversations about serious illness. These discussions can be difficult, but are essential for ensuring that patients receive the care that is aligned with their values and wishes. Our special guest today is Nancy Good-Kennedy, who is a palliative pain and symptom management consultant, and she will walk us through the process of a difficult conversation. Thank you for joining us today, Nancy.
Thank you, Lori. Thanks for the introduction. As mentioned, I have been in the field of palliation for many years, and I remain really super thankful for the time that I spent as a community nurse. That experience, I would say, paved my road with gold. And it was where I really learned that conversations don't just happen, Lori. They actually are in the planning, usually from the first meeting that you have with your patient. I also have been in absolute awe and inspired by the work of Dr. Atul Gande, as well as Ariadne Labs. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but they did develop the serious illness conversation guidelines that help patients and families and healthcare providers as well to navigate their way through these conversations. Really, I would say with empathy and clarity. That's how I see it. And by the end of our time together today, hopefully your listeners will have picked up a few practical tips, maybe heard a few stories, and feel confident initiating these conversations.
Yes, I'm sure they will pick up a lot of information from you today, Nancy. But can you tell us what is meant by a serious illness conversation and why would or should we be having them?
Thanks, Lori. Great question. And really a good way to get us right into the work. So when you really think about the definition of a serious illness, it's defined as a health condition that carries a high risk of mortality and either negatively impacts a person's daily function or their quality of life or excessively strains their caregivers. I think we cannot leave that behind us. You can probably guess that these conversations surround focusing on things like prognosis, goals of care, advanced care plans, cancer treatment decisions, and of course, end of life care. A serious illness conversation is exactly what it sounds like, a very serious conversation. And it is common. It's common in palliative care, for sure.
I can appreciate that these conversations may be considered difficult and have likely been tested and tried, but what is the actual history there? How did we get here?
So I mentioned earlier Dr. Atul Gande from Ariadne Labs, and I want to accredit him really for having developed a surgical checklist that guided his OR practices many years, and it was proved to be an effective tool for him. So then when he was faced with the need to have conversations with his patients about more advancing stages of disease, he was really wishing for a checklist. And the researchers at the Adirondack Labs, they did just that. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Jerry Powell podcast. Have you, Laurie?
Have you I watched have any of the Jerry Powell? I've watched several of those podcasts.
Yeah, they're excellent, aren't they? Right?
Yes. Yep.
So Eric Wadera and Alex Smith hosted Rochelle Bernaski and Joanna Palladino, I believe is her last name. They're both physician researchers, however, with Adirondack Labs. And in this particular episode, the researchers speak of their systems change project, and they reference two papers that they published in JAMA. They also supported and trialed the movement of a guide as a tool that we know today as the Serious Illness Conversation Guide. And on there, on Adirondack's kind of broader stage, they actually own and host the Serious Illness Care Program, which is an entire program that designs care so that knowing and honoring patients' promise or priorities become more of a norm rather than the exception. The Serious Illness Care Program, it is a system-level care delivery model, and it's created by a team of palliative care experts at the lab. That program intervention, I call it an intervention, it includes scalable communication tools for patients, families, and health professionals, all to align care with what is most important to the patients and also to strengthen relationships. So that is the program that we learn through Pallium, and it also has a clinician training included. It's a 2.5 hour workshop, and it's specifically designed to work into busy clinician work days as well, and meant to build confidence in the serious illness conversation. They support also includes support for leaders and champions to achieve systemic improvement in serious illness conversations and care. And finally, that program also partners with foundations, so healthcare systems and organizations with mission alignment. These partnerships allow for innovation, testing, and dissemination of our tools, curriculum design, and other educational offerings and system change elements. So I think this goal, and of course our goal, is for every seriously ill patient to have better and earlier conversations, Laurie, with the clinicians about their goals, their values, and their priorities that then informs their future care. So really, that's the history behind the tool that's been patient tested and tried. And it does serve that framework for all allied health professionals, really. So physicians, nurses, social workers, chaplains, and other clinicians to explore topics that really are crucial to gaining a full understanding about and honoring what is most important to the patients. So in clinical trials, the programs result in more earlier and better serious illness conversations, and they really do reduce anxiety and depression for patients. That research, I think, also demonstrates that the program is associated with improvements in patient and clinician experience. And we can't forget that there's a reduction in total medical expenses as well. Mm-hmm. So every person with a serious illness is known and cared for, really, on their own terms then.
Yeah, and that's really the most important piece of it all, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Nancy, why are these conversations so important?
So, besides the fact that I am the type of person that really likes to talk, it helps me get to know my patients really well. But when we or those that we love face really serious illness, we must make many personal medical decisions that can be frightening, difficult, and quite confusing. So individuals who have conversations with their clinicians about their values, their goals, and their wishes are more likely to receive the care that they want. They'll feel less distress and often report better quality of life. So compassionate and clear conversation is the key to easing confusion and fear and ensuring that decisions about care reflect what matters most to the patient. Again, what matters most to the patient? They should be in our forefront, 100%. I think that even as important as we agree these conversations are, a national study reported that only one third of the patients in their last year of life report having had these conversations. And often they happened too late in the course of illness to fulfill their most important wishes. And even though clinicians agree that conversations matter, 71%, can you believe that? 71% don't have a system in place to routinely ask about goals. They're missing the opportunity, really, to be part of a really deeply intimate, a human connection, which can help them get to the heart of what matters most with their patients. And even though that's a national study, there was also a study out of Markham Stouffville Hospital. I think it was Dr. Grill. He was the lead physician for the family healthcare team, and he did an encouraging conversations interview. Taking the Time to Talk, I think, is the name of that. It's released through the College of Physicians and Surgeons. And he found that there were about 26% of the primary physicians feeling comfortable leading these discussions, and 67% that felt they needed more resources. And that's close to home. So we can look at national surveys, we can look at local surveys, but I think they all tell us the same thing, Lori.
Wow. That's real, just seems hard to believe. It's such an important conversation, and it must be.
It's true.
It must just make it that much harder for the person going through it when you can't, you know, express how you want things done or. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in my mind, Lori, the purpose is to improve the patient experience when they're faced with a serious illness. Formal caregivers in hospice palliative care support persons with a life-limiting illness and their family members on a journey that will lead to death. Death is the inevitable outcome of being born, and it's a journey common to all living things. However, humans, by virtue of their ability to think and reason, are aware at both a conscious and an unconscious level of their eventual demise. That's actually from the fundamentals of palliative care. And the thought of death usually arouses a variety of anxieties and fears. And studies show that when patients talk about their goals and their preferences early on, they experience less anxiety and often receive care that better aligns with their wishes. Yet many people avoid these discussions until they're in a crisis. So we're being given an opportunity. We're being given an opportunity to be change makers, to work upstream, and to involve more providers to help better relationships with their patients and families, to ensure that sick people feel known and cared for on their own terms. And it really is critical that all caregivers have knowledge of dying and death. They must feel comfortable in its presence. And having a formal document to guide every step of the way, that's a tool to help so the providers can get comfortable. It truly is a gift.
Yeah, it really is. So Nancy, now that you have me on board, can you tell me about this guide What does it look like and how do you use it?
So let's break down the core concepts of Serious Illness Guide. It's not a script. It should never be used as a script, Lori, but it's a tool to guide a compassionate dialogue. So here's how it works. It's divided into two pieces. There's a left-hand column and a right-hand column. And the left-hand side is a conversation flow, and it's broken down into five areas. So first of all, you want to set up your conversation, asking permission to have the conversation. So that may sound something like, I would like to talk about what is ahead with your illness and do some thinking in advance about what's important to you so that I can make sure we provide you with the care that you want. And then, of course, asking for permission to continue. So is that okay? Right? The second piece is assessing the understanding that patient has of their prognosis. The guide actually states on the right-hand side, it gives you that patient-tested language. So, what is your understanding now of where you are with your illness? And how much information would you like from me? The third piece is sharing the prognosis with the patient in regard to their preference as to what they want to know. So, I want to share with you my understanding of where things are. Is this still okay? Always looking back to your patient to be sure that you still have them on board and that it is okay to move forward with that conversation. So, when you're exploring key topics, that's the fourth piece of the conversation guide. And what they state as those key topics would be things like the fears, the strengths of the patient, and what they state are critical abilities. So, what we mean by critical abilities, it's what is so important to the patient that they couldn't see themselves living without, like personal care, or we often hear that. We often hear that. And then the fifth piece is looking at trade-offs. So it is important for us to be able to help our patients understand that choices come with trade-offs. I really love seeing this in the guide. So what is the person willing to go through? Like, are they willing to leave their home for blood transfusion, for example? Or what type of treatment might they accept even to buy them more time? Or is that not something that they're wanting to do? And then, of course, closing off the conversation. And at this point, we'd summarize what we'd heard. So it's a listening conversation, 100%. And then the last part of the conversation is making recommendations, and you make those recommendations based on what you've heard from the patient. So I've heard you say that, repeat back to the patient what it is that they've shared with you, keeping in mind that your recommendation should be followed by a supportive close. So I appreciate you taking the time to coming into the office today. I'll be with you and I will support you and your family through this. So again, the right side is patient-tested language, and most of that testing was completed by Ariande Labs, and they did see a gap after their testing and then added in the strength questions. What brings strength to you? So for intent and purposes, the guide's meant to, one, prepare the clinician to explore the patient's values and to share a prognosis in accordance to what they're willing to hear. So that piece is so important. And it is always emphasized when we're doing workshops that don't cut the prognosis piece short. Be sure that you're engaging in prognostication, even if it's something like, I fear that this could be the strongest that you are going to feel. And never leaving that piece out of the conversation because people want to know. They want to know. The majority of people want to know. Maybe I should rephrase that and say the majority of people want to know. But really, in short, it's meant to improve the patient's experience when they're faced with a serious illness. And is that not why we're here? Is that not why we're doing the work we're doing? Right?
Yeah, 100%. So now that you've gone through all the components and how the conversation, could or should look, when is the best time to use this guide, Nancy?
So, integrating the tool is one piece, but really the tool is meant to be used with patients that have been identified as having a life-limiting illness. And the easiest way to do this is by the use of the surprise question. As old as it is, just ask yourself, would I be surprised if this patient were to die in the next year? If it's a cancer diagnosis, the year, or 2 years if it's chronic disease. But that should be an intuitive answer. It should be a feeling. It shouldn't, it's not a study, it's a question. It's, and if the answer is intuitively no, I would not be surprised, then this patient would most likely benefit from a serious illness conversation. And then just assess the understanding. Start with empathy and ask, what's your understanding of your current health? This opens the door for honest conversation without overwhelming the patient. And when you are sharing a prognosis, just be honest but compassionate. Tailor how much detail you share to what the patient wants to know. And then again, when you're exploring the goals and the fears, ask, just ask, what are your most important goals if your health worsens? This really does help align care with what truly matters to them. And then back again to discussing those trade-offs, understanding a patient's willingness to undergo certain treatments is crucial. So straight up, what are you willing to go through for the possibility of more time? And then when you document and communicate, you're recording preferences that ensures that the entire care team is informed and that they're respecting the patient's wishes. So be present, listen more than you speak, and allow silence. Silence is powerful.
It might allow them to continue talking more than they might have if you cut in.
That's exactly right. It gives them some time
Yeah, because those
and
aren't
time to
easy answers to
process.
come up with.
They're not. And there actually is a piece of this work that Ariadne Labs produces, where families are given or able to be provided with tools to take home to prepare in advance for these conversations. So that's a very important piece.
Yeah, because I sometimes I think, it might be the family that's having a harder time with all those questions than maybe the patient as well. So it's good for everybody to be, on the same team.
100%.
So Nancy, what motivated you to start using this serious illness conversation guide in your practice?
So, this was many years ago, Lori. Many years ago. I was at a meeting actually at hospice, and a topic of goals of care came forward. And I was given a copy of this guide, and it resonated with me right away. Then I heard physician researcher Rochelle Bernaski speak of the guide being representative of the bridge between the population in need and the patient that was right in front of her. And oh my God, it made complete sense to me. It was such a pearl for me to describe these conversations as being deeply intimate and being aware that while working in palliative care is endless, and certainly more demand than we can ever possibly fulfill. I also felt that. And then this coupled up with my belief that once we have knowledge, it truly is our responsibility to share that knowledge, to educate, to move the work forward, really, to have the opportunity to go to colleagues and move that work upstream, excited both the researchers just as it has me. And they definitely inspire my work. I've been using the guide, oh my God, for several years, but without any formal training. That I wish, I worry, I wonder statement was again an absolute pearl, an absolute pearl. But without that formal training, there is training now offered. So North Simcoe Muskoka has adopted the Canadian Serious Illness Conversation as one of their many offerings. And I'm happy to say that after completing certification with Pallium Canada, I now am able to move the work forward as a facilitator for the Canadian Serious Illness Conversations.
That's amazing, Nancy. Do you find that there are any challenges when having to face these conversations? And if there is, how do you overcome them?
So, you know what my dad used to say, anything worth having is worth working for. And again, that inspires me. We all know nothing comes without some sort of barrier. And I would say the most common things that I hear and feel are fears, like fears of upsetting loved ones, seeing them uncomfortable and the uncertainty, particularly in the presence of strong emotions, and then uncertainty about what to say, particularly with patients with low prognostication awareness. That's really difficult. And then again, not knowing the right time to bring things up. But I have always, and still, you've probably heard me say it many, many times, but don't ever leave a window wide open and not take an opportunity to engage your patients and families. And Dr. Gonde emphasizes talking early and often can make a world of difference. And I can tell you 100%, your attitude matters. Absolutely, I believe that. There was a study, Core Competencies for Serious Illness Conversations, and it's an integrative systemic review. Five researchers, including Joanna Polandino, they included 53 articles in this review, and they looked at interpersonal capabilities, including calibrating one's own attitudes and mindset, as well as confidence and self-assurance to engage in the serious illness conversations, and the interpersonal capabilities that focused on the clinician's ability to interact with patients and family members. It was meant to foster a mutually trusting relationship. And they did conclude that clinicians need to efficiently combine conversation resources with their interpersonal and interpersonal skills to successfully conduct and interact in the serious illness conversations. That was absolutely no surprise. No surprise to me at all, because I firmly believe that we walk in with an attitude and that attitude is conveyed to our patients and families 100% of the time. So goals of care conversations take practice, 100%, again, 100%. These conversations are about shifting our culture to find out about our patients. They're not a one and done conversation. And Dr. Grill also mentioned that in his article, that these should be ongoing conversations. He starts his conversations when his patients are 18 and he just continues them through. And he said things obviously do change over time for them. But a good question to ask your patient is simply, what do you hope for with your medical care? Anyone can ask that question. It doesn't matter what profession you are. Anyone can ask, what do you hope for with your medical care? And then with an application of knowledge, like clinical skills, interpersonal skills, problem-solving skills, clinical judgment, and technical skills all play a role in different professions. So everyone has a chance to speak to the conversation.
Right. So what advice do you have for clinicians that may be hesitant to initiate these talks?
Don't we all love to give advice, right? So listen without thinking about what to say. And then deep and active listening are necessary competencies for the serious illness conversation. I saw that in the research that I was doing many, many, many times. It does take time to build any skill. People receive and share information in different ways. They find a balance between using the structure of the guide, and in time, they'll be able to apply a unique skill set and then appropriately navigate the serious illness conversation. But that should never happen in the beginning. People are encouraged to follow the guide exactly as it is and to use that guide for 30 encounters before you kind of go offside, let's say. So I would say intentional silence could be utilized as a communication skill. You can then choose when to respond directly and when to use the power of silence. Using silence allows patients to process information, to express emotions and thoughts. This is a difficult one. Speaking, I would say, less than half of the time. It is a rule of thumb in this practice, and it creates space for patients' voice to be heard, and again, for them to process and reflect. So, what person-centered, general, relatable language, it should be used at anything that avoids medical jargon and lengthy monologues. So language and general tone can promote a supportive dialogue, which is meant really using neutral language. Open-ended questions, that's preferable. Creating a respectful setting, we've seen that for many years, and many people have given advice on how to actually set up a comfortable environment. Difficult emotions must be acknowledged, including addressing and responding to those emotions. So this can be difficult because people, I think, are afraid that it's going to stall their conversation, perhaps. But there's also a way to recognize that someone is emotional, but be able to move on and through that at the same time. So just saying something like, "I can see this is upsetting, Mr. Smith." Hold silence for a few minutes and then move on. It's not necessary to stay there nor to get stuck. Because this conversation is not about getting a DNR. It's none of those things. It's about finding out what your patient values. And the confidence, I would say the level of confidence is important too. The clinician needs to broach the serious illness conversation with comfort and confidence. And it's required when soliciting values in relation to the patient's illness. And it's important to feel confident when you use silence, bringing up sensitive issues like trajectories, fears, wishes, as well as when conveying updates, serious updates, sometimes managing conflict, because not everyone accepts their diagnosis or their prognosis. We know that. And counseling patient requests, right? Clinician confidence and investment in the serious illness conversation allows them to take responsibility for these conversations. And I think once you take responsibility for the conversation and you walk into that conversation with confidence, your patients feel that. They feel that, yes, you have the information in front of you, that you're ready to share with them, that you're not stumbling. It's okay to tell them that you're following a guide. You don't want to miss anything. So the discomfort, and especially described in relationship to discussing the prognosis, it really is about balancing hope and reality. And it can be challenging, but it's vital for the clinicians to have the capability really to give honest statements on what could lie ahead. It's also, I think, important to acknowledge uncertainty and frame those possibilities, discuss the hope and positivity, even in relationship to a poor prognosis. Recognizing reality sometimes while supporting hope, it's described as a gentle directness. I think that's a really good description. I really love that because it is gentle. It is caring. And then clinicians can portray this in a practice by using the approach I mentioned earlier. So hoping for the best, preparing for the worst. And then that hope and worry perspective, I use the wish, worry, wonder. I think that framework really resonates with me.
Yeah. Nancy, once the conversation has taken place, what are the next steps?
So documentation, I cannot forget to mention documentation. There's many areas now that are working on sharing and housing of information all in one space, so that information can be utilized by all disciplines. So having a template to add to the patient's electronic medical record, and that should include the patient's stated values or important goals as they get sicker, any really big concerns that they talk about, things that they might be worried about relative to their condition, and then end-of-life care preferences as well. And staff should be encouraged to utilize the patient's quotes as much as they possibly can in this documentation. And that is because it really gives the person that's reading that documentation a little bit of a snippet into that person's background, just on the types of comments they're making. So I think starting the conversation is often the hardest part. And certainly timing is key. So looking for natural openings, like a change in treatment or after hospitalizations. And remember, it's okay to be nervous. Showing you care matters more than saying the perfect words. Like, I want to understand what matters most to you so that we can plan your care together. And then I also would like everyone to understand that additional support through Adirondack Labs offers fantastic resources to help. They help you prepare, right? And yes. I think having this, it's a tool, Laurie. That's what it is, right? It's a tool to put in your toolbox. And yeah, actually, out of your toolbox would be better than in your toolbox the better part of the time.
Thank you, Nancy. As we wrap up, let's remember that these conversations are about honoring the person behind the patient. Don't wait for a crisis. Start talking today. You can visit the Ardon Labs website for tools and guidance to help you navigate these discussions with empathy and clarity. Thank you for joining me and Nancy on Beyond the Stethoscope today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. I know there Nancy gave us a lot of great information, and you can find more information on the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network website. They also offer the course, the Serious Conversation course. So if this is something that you would, you know, you think about you'd like to take and moving forward and add this to your practice too, yeah, you can sign up on the website. And I want to say thank you very, very much to Nancy. This was a great conversation that we just had, and you have given us so much to think about. So thanks again, Nancy.
Thank you for the opportunity. I will not miss an opportunity to push a serious illness conversation. Thanks, Laurie, very much.
Thank you. And I'll leave you with this quote. Your words can make all the difference. Until next time, take care of yourself and those you love. Thank you.